get 7.6 jobs. Ooh, it'll be mine.
Jesus.
That's part of
thank you.
The
I just,
a little tight.
Just wanted to wake up the committee this afternoon. Hello, everyone. Today is April 22nd, 2015, and in this time and place, I will convene the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Co-Chair Johnson, did you have something before we opened a public hearing?
I did. Colleagues, I'm not going to make a big deal out of this, but I just would like to share with you. You may recall during ODOT's budget hearing, I questioned Mr. Witte about whether or not he had traveled on behalf of the Vehicle Miles Traveled program. And I may have used the word traveled selling or traveled marketing. And I think he took rather cruel advantage of my inartful phraseology. Here is a copy of the 137 trips that he has taken nationally and internationally, including one scheduled for New Zealand on May the 4th. And I just wanted to make sure that you all had copies of that. Needless to say, Mr. Chair, this will not be the last conversation that we have on this subject, but considering that I asked him specifically on statewide, the answer was no. I asked him on international, and the answer was no. And you have in front of you a listing of quite a few international trips, London three times, Singapore, Austria, and I am pretty cranky. So I just share that with you.
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Actually, I think you misspoke. You said May 4th, and it's May 15th off to New Zealand, but also heading to Australia. I guess it's the Rhodes Australia Regional Conference in Sydney. The same day.
I stand corrected, and it makes one wonder where all these lovely frequent flyer miles. Well, never mind. Thank you.
Not at all. And this table resonates a little differently, so I'll try and tap a little lighter as I convene the public hearing on 5525. Mr. Bender, where are we flying to today?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. OBDD is going to be coming back and discussing their policy option package requests with you today. They also are going to be identifying the priorities for those funding within their total budget requests. So they'll be coming forward. And that should take up the rest of the day.
Excellent. Well, Mr. Robbins, Mr. Porter, are you first on the list? Who's going to lead off today? Please come on down.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sean Robbins, the Director of Business Oregon. Thank you for having us back for another day. As Mr. Bender indicated, we've been asked to walk through now all of our POPs, 1 through 18, and we've done so in priority order so that you can get a flow for what's sort of first on the list and what would be towards the end of the list, recognizing, of course, that we are always in a bit of a budget-scarce environment, so help you kind of through your thinking as we develop the budget. Of course, you'll recall the first 4 days in April and yesterday, the first 4 days in March, and yesterday, the fifth day, we've been walking you through sequentially through the entire agency set of programs, which are very diverse. We cover a lot of ground. Yesterday, we dove more deeply into the Governor's Regional Solutions as well as the Oregon Innovation Council. At the end of yesterday's meeting, Senator Johnson requested that we actually begin today's meeting with a bit of a discussion about some of the uniqueness of how the Regional Solutions program and the Oregon Innovation Council program uniquely affect our agency's budget. So we prepared a few short comments to that effect before we get into the POPs, if that's okay with the chair.
Please.
So a couple of to the senator's question at the end of the day yesterday, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it for a few minutes, and I'll try to keep the comments relatively short and contained. First, both of these programs are essential community and economic development programs for the state. But starting with Regional Solutions as the first of the two, As you know already, Regional Solutions is a five-party consortium, five agencies working together in order to solve problems at the regional level throughout the state. Work housing and the DEQ and Business Oregon. And they coordinate on a regular basis with many of our on-the-ground folks to make sure we're breaking down the barriers. Mission is incredibly important to the work that we do. But of those five agencies that have come together as part of the Regional Solutions, Business Oregon carries 100% of the project budget for the Regional Solutions program going forward to the 2015-2017 budget. That's the $22 million number that you'll recall from yesterday's testimony. So we have five agencies working together to solve problems on the ground, and our agency has been uniquely put in the position of responsibility yet for carrying 100% of those project costs. We're happy to do it. As the senator has said before, we're beady-eyed bankers, so we're good.
Mr. Chair, I want the record to reflect that I use the word beady-eyed bankers as a sense of endearment and affection and a reflection on the highest level of professional standards in scrutinizing financial statements and project pro forma.
There's very little I can answer to that. I said it perfectly, and we appreciate that. We take pride in that, actually. And so with that responsibility, of course, what it does in a new budget request process is, if you will, it eats up significant real estate in our future funding requests for other priorities. In a similar way on Oregon Inc., if you will, this is the fifth biennium in which the legislature has made innovation and entrepreneurship a key part of its economic development strategy, a very thoughtful decision at the time and a continued right decision in the last four biennia up to this point. But one of the things that has happened is that by treating it as a perpetually new program every 2 years, we come back here and talk to you as though this is a new program and a new idea. And unlike many other agencies who have a long-term commitment from the legislature to carry forward a program, we also have to include that as part of a new funding budget item, even though it's been going on for 8 years in the past. And so again, in a similar way to Regional Solutions, it eats up significant amount of real estate in our budget. And the reason that that matters is that over time, it begins to, if you will, crowd out other investments in other key, just as key, mission-critical areas, infrastructure, business finance and access to capital, our business retention and recruitment teams, the global trade and exports team, all of that work gets a smaller and smaller portion, if you will, of the airtime, as well as some of the budget real estate that we have as an agency. And so I say that only to provide the proper context that most of the budget real estate you see is in really two POPs, POP requests, and many of the smaller numbers that are left over for what we have as limitation are just as equally important but don't always get the necessary attention that they might deserve because of it. This is, of course, to say nothing of sort of the third leg to this, which is the agency's ongoing commitment to debt service because of the lottery bonds that we take on for many projects, many of which are economic development related, but sometimes are put in our agency to fund, and then we carry the debt service for the next 30 years. As an example, the Regional Solutions Program, $14 million of the 22 is actually lottery bond money. The debt service for that lottery bond money will continue on inside our agency for the next 30 years, as an example, increasingly over time, and that, too, has a bit of a limiting effect on what we can do for business development.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
If memory serves me correctly, there was a parking garage in Hillsboro that had a $4 million bond component. Even though that is not an agency request, it was a policy bill. That debt, I believe, was also dumped into your agency, was it not? I mean, it was nothing you asked for. You just become, because you have such highly flexible money, kind of a parking lot for program and debt.
I can't speak to the specific example, Senator Johnson, but generally speaking, that is correct.
And your fiscal agent behind you is nodding yes. I was just double-checking my memory on it. One other thing, Mr. Chair.
Please.
This also predates you, but there were times in this building when the revenue forecast was down a breathtaking $500 million, and we were doing across-the-board reductions. How is that debt treated in your budget? And maybe you want to call your fiscal lifeline, but how is that debt treated in your budget when you are required to make across-the-board reductions?
So what I'll attempt to answer that, Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, and of course, if I have to bail, I'll call my chief financial officer. Generally speaking, you can't not pay your debt service. So when the state makes a commitment to float a bond, pay the debt service for 30 years, you have to come good on your coupon payment. And when it comes time to make 5%, 10%, 20% agency cost reductions, whether it's in a recession where the budget is significantly less than expected, or even in the biannual planning process where we have to make proactive guesses at what we would do in a reduction situation, we have to actually grab deeper and further into other agency operations because we can't skip the debt service payment. So, for example, in 2013, 2015 biennium, out of every dollar that was in our budget, 40 cents of it was debt service payments. So what happens is, for example, in a 20% reduction scenario to the overall budget, we have to reach, say, 30% deeper into core mission-critical activities because of the debt service situation.
Thank you. That was exactly what I was getting at. Thank you.
Very good. If that satisfies the committee, I will move on and start the afternoon then with a review of all 18 policy option packages. And I hope you'll forgive, we will work to get people up here carefully and quickly to move and transition between some of these. I will be here for all of them, for the bulk of them, I should say. And because they're in priority order, I will spend a little bit more time up front on the first half, and we might start to shorten the time towards the other half. So if you see the clock and you see the first half and you think I got to multiply that by two to figure out when I'm getting out of here, that would be the improper math. So this here represents the first nine. Again, remember, these are in priority order. The second slide will walk you through. There's many policy option packages as part of our budget request. This is a simple reminder to reacquaint you in a summary fashion about what those are. I don't want to linger on this list too long because we'll get into the details as we go here one by one. Now, the Oregon Innovation Council, we heard a lot about this yesterday. This constitutes the state's commitment since approximately 2007 to broaden and diversify its economic development strategy to include innovation and entrepreneurship. Really, the bulk of it is split between signature research centers and innovation initiatives, if you will. Signature research centers are, and the innovation is, are grow into each other or have the potential to grow into each other. A couple key metrics that I do want to point out for this particular program, as we continue to drive clearer, more transparent metrics in every program that we do in this agency. There were 90 companies that have been supported or created as a result of this program, for a combined total of those companies attracting $580 million of additional follow-on funding, both private equity funding, but also additional federal grant funding to follow on basic research and development. So with a $77 million investment from the state since 2007, the calculated ROI for every state dollar in is about $7 out of private sector additional follow-on return from this program. And overall, there's about 300 companies that have been using the shared research labs that exist at the signature research centers of ONAMI, OTRADI, and Oregon Best. If there aren't any more detailed questions at this point, we covered a lot of ground on this yesterday. I don't want to belabor it unless there's a specific question from the committee.
Let's keep going.
Very good. With that, There we go. The Oregon Infrastructure Opportunity Fund. And I want to provide a little bit more detail on this one because this is a new program that's being proposed. And it's in large part driven out of the state tour we did last year, meeting with communities across the state, when we asked folks, especially communities outside of the urban and metro cores of the state, what was the single most impactful thing that we could do to help support community economic development. The consistent answer after workforce was infrastructure. basic infrastructure. But not just any kind of infrastructure, infrastructure that's tied more nearly to near-term job creation. So the purpose of this fund is to create a flexible fund that would be invested into near-term job creation projects, if you will, a last mile of infrastructure funding, where there is a project, a deal, an expansion, a recruitment that is about to come together, but for basic investment in the infrastructure to service the site or the company may not happen, or we're competing with other states. The picture that I showed on the first slide actually is by now in this session the famous Juntura Road in eastern Oregon. But instead of focusing on Juntura Road, I actually wanted to provide some go-forward examples of what this would look like in the future. I had our business development team pull out and extract from our customer relationship management software before today deals that are in the prospective recruitment pipeline that fit the rural definition who needed infrastructure. Today, as we speak, just in the recruitment side, not on our retention expansion side, there are six projects scattered throughout Oregon that just our agency is working on that combined would produce 1,265 jobs and represent $385 million of future investment in the state. And I'll give you an example of some of the things that the infrastructure that's needed when we compete for these projects with other states. Road, water, wastewater, transportation access, multiple needs in transportation. The type of fund that we are trying to set up for this gives us another tool in our tool belt in order to be able to close the gap with states that we are competing with actively. One example here is a wood products manufacturing company that's looking in rural Oregon. I happen to know that that company is looking both in California and the state of Washington at prospects. Right now, the set of tools that we have as a state are fairly limited and contained, and especially on another one in which we're dealing with competition from Nevada, who's very aggressive in landing these companies, far more aggressive with the tool set that they have often. This would provide us another tool in our tool belt to help try and close the gap on these six projects, ones that I know will grow over time, but also will be expanded when we really get into the business retention expansion piece of monitoring the analytics to our pipeline. That's the vision for this fund. It's ranked number two on our priority list because we heard consistently outside the metro areas infrastructure was something that communities needed in order to compete with other states. And this gives us that tool. Number three, regional solutions. Like Oregon Inc., we've spent significant amount of time on this topic yesterday as well. You'll recall the governor's lead on this, Annette Leba, and several folks in testimony provided some background to you on this. Again, I won't go into great depth about this, as well as my opening comments this morning. I think we've covered this fairly well. Again, unless somebody has a specific question you'd like me to answer. Great. With that, Mr. Schessler, if it satisfies the chair, I'd like to invite Lynn Schessler, our Assistant Director of Infrastructure Finance Authority, to come up and walk you through the next two, which is about brownfields and the Special Public Works Fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Schessler, for the record, as Sean reflected, the Assistant Director for Infrastructure Finance. The Brownfields program we talked about a little bit before, it's a $7 million request. The last time the fund was capitalized was in back 2007. I think the important bottom line factor that I want to leave with you is that every dollar that the state has invested in that has leveraged $116 of someone else's money. Can't hardly beat that rate of return. Right now, the revolving loan fund has about $400,000 remaining. All that funding is under pending obligations to projects that are in development. If you have the question of what's going to happen if you do are able to fund the $7 million request, my staff can quickly recite for you over $10 million worth of projects that will get going. What's interesting to me about the Brownfields program is it has a variety of results. And I want to describe a few of those to you. For instance, in Hillsboro, there was a gas station that remediation measures were made towards, provided the opportunity for a young woman to start a coffee shop and pastry shop. that in and of itself is laudable, certainly. Used the brownfield, got a business started, but she was very successful. And because of that start on a brown or a former brownfield site, now she has 5 shops and 100 employees. So curiously, it led to something much bigger and better for the economy as a result of that one site. A different result is a reclaimed project in Josephine County is now the regional food bank property. Another, of course, is what's cited in the pictorial example, and that's the international port at Newport, or the international pier. That was a project that's got a lot of press in the past few years, and not recently, but I wanted to remind folks of that. In terms of outcomes, we anticipate the $7 million recapitalization will provide assessments for an additional 20 properties to get them started. In terms of cleanup, we would expect 1 to 2 more loans on properties that would be then thoroughly cleaned up. And what I really want to point out is the final factor, and that is that $7 million becomes part of a revolving loan fund. It isn't gone, it isn't spent and lost. It comes back as those loans are repaid and can be recycled back into the program. It doesn't double the program's revolving fund at present, but it nearly does. Present fund is about $9 million. A $7 million addition would make a substantial difference in what we can do each biennium.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Nierman.
On the slide there, it says that the fund is nearly out of money.
Yes.
If the design of the fund is to loan money out and then to replenish itself, how does it run out of money there?
Of the $9 million, it's all committed. It's lent out. There's only $400,000 that isn't working on a project right now. Those funds get paid in part on an annual payment. We reloan those out too. That's where the $400,000 that's remaining comes from. When that $400,000 is committed, then we'll have to wait till the annual payment comes back on those revolving funds till we'll have another $400,000 that we can loan out. So we've got a pretty small project or pretty small program without recapitalization.
I see. So you're trying to grow the size of the whole fund. Then. Okay.
Senator Johnson.
The grant and loan program, Mr. Chesler, I should know this, and I don't. How do you differentiate who is acceptable for a loan versus who gets an outright grant? Did you cover that?
I did not cover that, Senator Johnson. Essentially, the grant portions are for investigative work, much in the concept. I think we're trying to develop the levy program.
Yeah, how bad is it? And then you figure out the scope of the problem.
What do we have to do? And then once we know that, loans for the actual repair work.
Thank you.
That makes sense.
Moving along then to the Regional and Local Infrastructure Development Fund. This is a very confusing title for you that should simply have said Special Public Works Recapitalization. We've talked about this before as well. We're seeking a general recapitalization of $14 million. Okay. Levy and inspection and repair program at $7 million and $7 million also for patient capital for industrial lands. The Special Public Works program is the most flexible funding that I think the infrastructure division has. It has its limitations though, and hence, as Sean was describing, the Infrastructure Opportunity Fund, larger capitalization can be provided with that fund. The Special Public Works grant limitation is $1 million. So we're also seeing a significant shift in the requests for the Special Public Works Fund, that being for job creation activities, infrastructure financing, rather than the former bread and butter water and wastewater systems in communities. That increasing demand, while we still try and pay attention to, you know, core functions, is stretching the fund. We've had examples that we've discussed with you before, such as the pretreatment plant in Boardman. We've financed workforce housing infrastructure in Pendleton. In the Dalles, we financed the infrastructure for the industrial park that created 50 acres of available land for industry development. But it's also the fund that we find little pieces of money to investigate and find out to the degree of problem that the milk vetch is for the Klamath Airport. And so As a result of the nominal amount of money we contributed to that study, $8 million of federal money was made available to improve the runway and the lighting system at that airport. We would expect the recapitalization to provide 15 to 20 grants for the levy program and probably three or four loans for small projects.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I'd like to stop and put a special exclamation point on that, because given what some of us know about the need for dike and levee repair, particularly since we have been abandoned by our federal partners and Oregon is on our own, $7 million is a drop in the bucket. And I am quite interested in what you just said, that this would come out in a series of small loans. And I think it's important on the record to state that that line item does not solve one problem. At least that's the way that I have envisioned it. There may be others that think differently, but that fund could be subscribed in one project.
Senator Johnson and members of the committee, you're absolutely right. It could be. I'm hoping that it is not. Frankly, the largest projects, the largest problems are beyond the scope of any program we have. We would have to go to some sort of bonding activity to raise the kind of capital that those projects need. But there are some small projects. With the fund, I'm hoping that we get 15 to 20 levies reviewed and inspected and figure out to what degree do they have a problem and have money left over then to do the $1 million repair or the $2 million repair to three or four levies at least.
And colleagues, just to advocate for this absolutely shamelessly, if one's property is behind an uncertified water management device, a dike or a levee, it conceivably could have zero value. I think there is a direct correlation between economic development and the preservation of value in the assets that are behind these uncertified dikes and levees. This is something we have to do, and this is going to be an ongoing responsibility of the state for a long time since the feds have abandoned us. Let me ask a question while you struggle trying to decide how to respond. remind me what that regional coordinator position is.
Part of our recapitalization request is to have an other funded revenues from the loans that we make regional coordinator. We do not match our regional field staff with the regional solutions areas around the state. And so we are presently, we have a regional coordinator for two of the areas of Eastern Oregon. We have other regions that are being shared by an individual. We're trying to match our number of field staff with the number of regional solutions areas so that we have staff on the ground assisting communities in every region.
Okay, so this would be to bring it up to a full complement of 11. This might not be the math, but the idea is to have a coordinator in every one of the 11 regions with all of the concomitant costs, the CAR, the SNS, all the rest of that.
That's right.
Okay.
But not lottery funded.
Right. Thank you.
The general recapitalization request is critical as I gauge our demand for industrial properties, the water, the wastewater projects. My prediction is somewhere within the next biennium, depending on demand, our ability to make commitments will have reached the capacity of our fund. So to continue on and finish out the biennium, the recapitalization is essential. And again, much like with the brownfield fund description, that additional money goes into a revolving fund. It isn't spent and gone. It is part of a revolving pool that will generate additional revenue in the future and be available to address more communities' problems.
Very good. So moving on to POPs numbers 6, 7, and 8. I actually like to take these in a.
Maybe Mr. Witte could assist you as he's traveling internationally. It was just a thought. I'm trying to get extra bang for the buck. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Numbers 6, 7, and 8. These are probably the most
unglamorous POPs requests, but I would say if I could put a number 1, 2, and 3 asterisks on any of them, it would be 6, 7, and 8. These are people. We have three core areas, the first being global trade exports and foreign direct investment. The second one you'll see after this one is the research and analytics division that we've created, one key staff person, as well as one Oregon Growth Board individual. Now, to remind you, we are an agency of 135 people serving the entire state of Oregon in the global economy. I know that adding people is not the favorite duty of the legislature, but I am telling you these are critical adds of personnel in our agency going forward to put in place the strategy of Grow Our Own. The international trade promotion capacity is really one individual. Our entire global trade team is managed by four people for the entire state of Oregon who do all of the exports work to help small and medium-sized business take their products, manufactured products, overseas to drive sales. It's probably one of our most effective programs in the state in a return on investment. We are ranked number one of the top 10 states for exports. Our economy is based on manufacturing. We're asking for one additional person to round out that team, in part to drive a new foreign direct investment strategy back into the U.S., because we're increasingly seeing Southeast Asia and Japanese companies who are interested in bringing some manufacturing options back, especially to the West Coast. But we as a state do not have a strategic plan in place of how to drive those foreign direct investment decisions here to Oregon, as opposed to, quite frankly, California and Washington, who do. And we are often overlooked in that space from abroad. We're somewhere lost between Seattle and San Francisco, if you will. The research analyst, one of the things we did upon coming on board last year was we created a research and policy division using big data, customer analytics to drive our entire business development strategy so that we can better target retention and recruitment opportunities across the country and across the world. We're asking for one additional person for that staff. I believe that full complement we have working on your behalf is 5 people right now. There is a desperate need for a 6th in that division. The Oregon Growth Board. One of the things, as you recall from our innovation and entrepreneurship approach, is divided into 3 core activities: nurturing the ecosystem, tech transfer and commercialization, and the third is driving more entrepreneurial capital to the state. In the last legislative session, the legislature funded a half-time position inside of our agency to work with the Oregon Growth Board. As a result, many of the folks who have expertise in this area weren't interested in working for a half-time salary, so we had to hire a consultant to administer, and has done a fantastic job with it. We're asking for the other half of that half-time person that we receive funding for so that we can truly integrate the work of the Oregon Growth Board into the state's full innovation and entrepreneurship strategy going forward. So it's really a half, 2.5 people as opposed to 3 people.
Representative Whitson.
Could you describe nurturing the ecosystem?
Oh, yes.
The ecosystem? That was one of the things that you said,
yes,
that they did. And so could you give a description of what nurturing the ecosystem is?
So there is a tremendous amount, Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitson, there are a tremendous amount of actual investments that are made into small business accelerators and small business incubators. That is the operations throughout the state trying to launch and create new companies. I believe the state has roughly 15. There's angel conferences that are being organized throughout the state to try and pull out local angel capital out of the existing investor base to put that money to work for new companies and firms who are starting up who want to capitalize that operation. There's incredible amount of service providers with the SBDCs throughout the state, the Oregon Entrepreneurs Network throughout the state. All of these individual institutions are not-for-profits,
and oftentimes undercapitalized. Instead of us as a state creating a redundant infrastructure of all of those entities who provide that support to the small businesses, we are taking the approach that we would rather invest into those existing institutions who do the work better than the state government ever could. And part of that responsibility of the Innovation Entrepreneurship Growth Group is to make smart, targeted investments and turning the business model into one where we are actually asking them to compete for those funds, not making grants for those funds going forward.
Follow up?
May I suggest you call it something different than an ecosystem? Because
Absolutely.
That's a really bizarre term for most of us. Think of ecosystem as something different than what you just described. It would probably help people be a little happier with it.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, thank you for the counsel. The next is the Industry Competitiveness Fund. This fund is part of our ongoing work to try to create additional industry capacity in some core areas. One of them is the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. Here to talk about that is Chris Shearer from the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. This is our pathway to helping small and medium-sized manufacturers in the state of Oregon. It's an incredibly powerful program with federal government funds that we're really providing a match towards going forward.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomberg and Co-Chair Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Chris Shearer, and I'm president of Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, better known as OMEP.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify before the subcommittee today. Oregon is a manufacturing state. A higher proportion of Oregonians depend on manufacturing for jobs than in nearly any other state in the U.S. OMEP's consulting staff of engineers, former company owners, and managers are able to help manufacturers of all sizes throughout the state stay competitive in the global marketplace. We know that our work is effective because of our long history of reported results. At the conclusion of each consulting engagement, our clients are surveyed by an independent third party, and among others, four key performance indicators are reported out each quarter. And those are cost savings, increased and retained sales, internal reinvestment, and jobs created and retained. On the basis of this survey data, PSU's Northwest Economic Research Center calculates that over the last 12 years, OMEP services have resulted in nearly $2.2 billion in increased economic output, 14,693 jobs, and increased state and local taxes of approximately $78 million. As indicated on one of the pages of your handout, our record of return on investment over the last 12 years is nearly 30 to 1. For the most part, these accomplishments have been achieved with a biennial state contribution of $500,000. This money has been used in combination with our ongoing federal allocation to make our client fees more affordable, and especially for smaller and more rural companies. Last March, during the short session, the legislature was able to provide us a one-time boost of $750,000 to support increased outreach and services to rural and smaller manufacturers. The roster of participants that's included in your handout shows the companies that OMEP has been able to reach as a result of that money since May 2014. And there's a misprint that says 2015, but that was a year ago at this time, essentially. I'm very pleased to report that our ability to reach smaller companies in more rural areas has far exceeded our previous efforts, and we're not done yet with a couple of months left in the fiscal year. I also want to stress that we're able to use these state funds to leverage other money to grow these programs beyond the limit of their direct allocation. And in this case, we calculate that we were able to leverage an additional $335,000 in federal funds, and that we wouldn't have been able to access otherwise because of a match shortfall. And we were able to attract $140,000 in client service fees to augment these efforts. Recently, we underwent a recompetition for our federal award, and were successful and awarded a federal-based funding that doubles our access to federal funds. So it's tremendous news for Oregon manufacturers, but without strong state support to provide sufficient match, we would not be able to fully draw on our federal allocations. So this request is really important to us and the clients we serve.
So in conclusion, I urge you to support the full policy option package for OMAP, funding at $750,000. In addition, we are requesting $250,000 for the biennium to bring our biennial funding increase to $1 million. And this is the amount that was requested last spring by Business Oregon and would result in total funding for OMAP of $1.5 million for the biennium. This will allow us to make the best use of our new federal funds, ensure superior service to manufacturers of all sizes in all regions of the state. We have proven programs that are ready to roll and look forward to your decisions this session. And as discussed, we believe this is an economic development investment that provides a fast return and is a wise use of state funds. Thank you for your time, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Scherr? Senator.
You have some client fees. Can that be plowed back into use as match? I mean, do you just consider that earned revenue?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, that is plowed back and recycled in terms of supporting additional activities. So we use those funds to expand our total organization and as partial use of match. The state match is actually a minority of our match.
How much is the return client fees?
I think we're this year looking at about $1.3 million from the client fees. So it's a substantial part of the match, in fact, the majority of it.
And you may have said this. How many staff do you have?
We have 18 staff currently. We're hoping in the next budget year to grow to 21.
Thank you, Senator. Other questions? Mr. Scherr, I'm just perusing your list of participating companies, and it looks at first glance to be primarily within the I-5 corridor. A few examples, I-5 corridor plus Bend Redmond. Mm-hmm. A few examples further east. I don't see anything that I would appear to be west of I-5. Could you just comment on the regionality of this list for me a bit?
Well, first we have to serve the companies where they are, and the vast majority of them are on the I-5 corridor and clustered around the Bend area. In past years, we've been successful at reaching some of the companies out further east, and we're currently working with a provider out there to kind of re-enter that area. Really, it's one of the reasons that state funding is so important. It's really expensive for us to serve those areas. The travel there and back, as you can imagine, is a day or two. The clients are not able to bear the cost of that, so that has to be paid by us, and our access to funds is limited. So you're correct in your assessment. The primary efforts that we initiated as a result of this additional funding were centered in our remote offices in Medford, Roseburg, and Bend. So it makes sense that the clients would cluster around those areas. We do try to go as far west as we can. We've got a client now in Cave Junction, and I think we've got at least two on the coast. So,
Senator Johnson.
I'm just trying to understand how you've got 18 staff now, you want to go to 21, you need more capital available to make match. Why would you be expanding personnel right now? That's a cost that you can control.
So the personnel that we were, Chair Gomberg and Senator Johnson, the increase in staff would be an increase in consulting staff. The limit really on how many clients we can serve is the number of consultants we have. In an analysis that we've provided to the subcommittee in the past, it shows a clear correlation between the impact we're able to have and the number of clients / number of consultants that we have. So our desire to expand is a desire to serve more companies.
I have a question.
Other questions? Yes, Representative.
I was wondering if you could explain what kind of growth you expect from the company Two Old Hippies Breedlove Guitar out of Bend, Oregon?
Well, without disclosing, Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, without disclosing proprietary information, I happen to know a lot about guitar manufacturing since I'm a guitar player, but their desire is to be able to increase their effectiveness and efficiency of producing a guitar in a certain price range, which is sort of the sweet spot for guitars. So they're particularly interested in building their Oregon brand. So they have an actual Oregon guitar that's made out of Oregon woods, and we've been assisting them in being able to be more efficient in their manufacture of guitars. I mean, a guitar factory is rather like all factories with respect to the need for certain regulated processes, and like a lot of companies that started off in the craft world, they sort of slowly move over to a more productive, modern, contemporary environment with respect to production, and that's what we do for them. Does that answer your question, Representative Woodson?
I was just wondering if you could tell us how many employees they expect to employ, and you know what we can expect from that. What the investment was? Could you provide us with what your investment was in this list of 18?
Well, I think in this case, bear with me a second. Chair Gomberg and Representative Whitsitt, we worked with this company to help some of the company leaders understand better business practices. So often, especially in a specialty environment like guitars, you'll find people that are attracted to the craft element, good woodworkers, musicians themselves, but don't have a strong background in business. So in this particular case, the Business Innovation Workshop was designed to teach these entrepreneurial or smaller business owners and leaders how to effectively structure their business and manage in areas of finance, marketing, production, employee management, and leadership. So that's the work we're doing for them.
Could you provide us with the amount of money paid to these companies and what you did with the money for them, or what they're doing for us with the money?
So we estimate that the cost to a company for this workshop would be, if they had to actually pay for it themselves, would be $10,000. It's not just attending a workshop. We do extensive follow-up on-site with the company. So if we were to charge fees for all those at our normal standard rate and no subsidy, there would be a cost of $10,000. Because of our $750,000 in state funds, we're able to provide that service for on a sliding scale anywhere from no money to $2,500. I'm not sure specifically what fee was paid by Breedlove to attend these, but I can easily get back to you with that information.
And those workshops and business skill programs, how is that distinct from what's going on in our small business development centers?
Chair Gomberg, our work is specific to manufacturing and focused on the specialty of that industry.
Okay. Other questions? Ms. Robbins.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Part of the POP number 9, number 2 in this list, the second largest piece of that package as we unpack it is the SYRSTTR program, sort of like the word ecosystem. It's another one of these entrepreneurial terms that make little sense to those actually in it. It's the Small Business Innovation Research grant process that the federal government conducts to help small startups in biotechnology, nanotechnology, et cetera. We have a very successful SBIR state matching program here in the state of Oregon. It's a relatively small program. This is a recapitalization of $500,000 into that particular program. The innovation initiatives. These are, if you'll recall from the presentation yesterday, from the Oregon Innovation Council, sort of like the Industry Competitiveness Fund, has a number of elements inside of it, one of them being as you heard, talked about yesterday quite a bit by the Regional Solutions team, a project that originated out of the Regional Solutions process, the Regional Accelerator and Innovation Network, or RAIN, in the South Willamette Valley. You heard quite a bit about that yesterday. I won't necessarily need to unpack that any more for you unless you'd like to, but I have asked Jamie Munn from Blount International to be here, who works with the Oregon Metals Initiative, to talk a little bit about that piece to it, which, as you can see in the total 3.2 POP request, is $2.2 million. It's the largest piece of it, and I'd like to have them speak for just a minute or two about that element.
Welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you very much. I am Jamie Munn, here today representing Blount International. I am the R&D engineering manager with Blount, and I also serve as a director on the boards for both OMI, Oregon Metals Initiative, and the Northwest Collaboratory for Sustainable Manufacturing. A little bit about Blount. Blount International is a global manufacturer and marketer of replacement parts, equipment, and accessories for the forest, lawn, and garden, farm, ranch, and agricultural, and and concrete cutting and finishing markets. Blount sells its products in more than 115 countries in the world. As a leader of innovation and quality, Blount produces saw chains, bars, sprockets, that are well respected in the chainsaw and forestry industries. And we sell outdoor equipment, accessories, and parts for the garden and landscape industry. And in fact, Blount is the market leader in manufacturing saw chain.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Could I interrupt your testimony long enough to ask who started Blount?
Joe Cox started Blount in the 1940s here in Oregon.
Was John Gray affiliated with the company?
So John Gray was hired by Joe Cox to help run the business. Okay. And eventually purchased the business from Joe Cox.
Thank you. I was trying to remember that. I mean, obviously, Mr. Gray, one of Oregon's preeminent philanthropists. We are a lesser place from his passing, but a remarkable, yes. Iconic Oregonian.
Yes, he was. So Blount has been both a member of both the Oregon Metals Initiative and the Collaboratory since their inception. I don't believe I need to go into much depth on the Oregon Metals Initiative because it's been around for a number of years, and I believe.
One important thing. We hear a lot of requests in all of our different legislative capacities where people are coming into the legislature and asking for money. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the remarkable aspects of the Metals Initiative is, and correct me if I don't have this right, but the participating companies all are contributing basically a one-to-one match.
You are correct, Senator Johnson. That is, I believe, what is unique in our request for this policy option package is that industry fully matches at a one-to-one ratio any funds that we request that go to the universities, industry matches. So the 2.2 that you see is also fully matched at a $2.2 million rate by industry to fund research in our Oregon universities.
And one other thing. Again, my memory may be a little faulty on this, but as I recall, some of the things that you all are pioneering, one of them was a weld that could be applied in a marine environment, a highly corrosive marine environment, that it was actually the R&D happened in Oregon. And that weld is now being used on bridges like the Golden Gate that are subject to enormous weather and other structural forces.
Senator Johnson, correct. I'm not overly familiar with the details and the nuances of it, but I have seen the prototype welding equipment at the lab at Portland State University, just off of the OMSI Museum. There was a research lab there, and I have seen the equipment, and they did demonstrate it for me, and I was able to see it working, and they talked to me about that. So it's not something necessarily we use at Blount, but yes, that is one of the things.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Please continue.
All right, thank you. So actually, I believe that sort of does lead into my example of why I'm here today, which is Blunt's collaborative project that we are actually working with both the Northwest Collaboratory for Sustainable Manufacturing and OMI. A little bit of background on common metal machining or grinding, as we do a lot in making our chainsaw chain. It's common practice in manufacturing to supply coolant or cutting coolant liquid to the workpiece to add both lubricity to cool the metal, to prevent transformation of the material properties, and to flush away the removed metal. Oregon State University researchers have recently discovered a method to use electricity to soften the workpiece at the contact point between the cutter and the workpiece, and thereby reducing the cutting forces on the cutter, which will extend its life, and will eliminate the need for coolant, which has enormous cost and environmental impact in manufacturing. And it will also provide a better surface finish from the machine surface. OSU is also concurrently researching the sustainability of replacing this new methodology with current and existing methodologies which allow businesses to understand the environmental, the economic, and the performance attributes of this manufacturing methodology change. While Blunt, Benchmade Knives, and Boeing do not make similar products nor have similar customers, we all use this same process. And all three leading Oregon companies have collaborated together with these leading researchers that were initially funded from the last biennium to actually come to Oregon and work at Oregon State University and do research. They were the ones who uncovered the process. We are funding them with OMI funds and our own funds to conduct this research and employ graduate students and undergraduate students to discover this new, really truly cutting-edge manufacturing process. There will be gains in environmental and economic economic costs to multiple companies, multiple Oregon companies, by collaborating together on this project, which will help us remain competitive in our global market. So thank you for your support. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Hop number 11. So just as a time check, we're about 4 o'clock. We're more than halfway through. We're going to start speeding up on some of these. Vince Porter from the governor's office, the governor's economic and jobs policy advisor, will actually speak to this element as part of the original governor's recommended budget.
Thank you, Sean. For the record, my name is Vince Porter. I'm policy advisor for Governor Brown and jobs and the economy. So on POP number 11, this is actually a two-tier, and I believe Annette Leiba spoke about the other half of this request, which was for the regional solutions coordinators. I know in the conversation about ecosystem, this may be another one that's a bit confusing, but the multi-state strategies position is essentially our staff position that works for not only the governor's office but the whole state of Oregon in D.C. And the reason why multi-states was brought up is that, or mentioned as part of the description of the job, is an era of no earmarks in D.C., what we found in the last year or beyond is that the need to work with not only our congressional delegation but other states' staff in D.C. to go after programs that are within the federal agencies like the USDA, Department of Commerce, and others that require multi-state efforts. There was a manufacturing competition that we needed to partner with South Carolina and Washington to go after funds there. With USDA, Tallwood building challenges. So really having someone on the ground working for the governor's office but also the entire state of Oregon, we feel is a critical element for moving forward and working with our federal partners. I'm not sure the history behind it. I believe in 2013 it was when this position was put into Business Oregon. I was not around for the history behind why it carried over into this budget. I think certainly the governor's office is flexible about where it lands, but we do want to emphasize that we feel it's very critical that it does pop up somewhere in someone's budget.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I guess I'm just at that point in the session where truthiness matters, and I would much rather get rid of this sort of highfalutin title, as you alluded to. I am very supportive of us having someone on the ground in Washington, D.C. Despite the fact that there are no longer earmarks, I think having the opportunity to put together these mosaics of funding is very important. What annoys me about this is that it's the targeted sectors being energy efficiency. We're doing so much around energy efficiency right now in Oregon. The tap seems unlimited on at the Energy Trust of Oregon. I mean, $300+ million is going to slosh through that operation. And I don't know why, given our limited resources, we seem to continue to drift back to the notion of energy efficiency. That waterfront seems covered. And I guess I'm just asking that perhaps we look in some different other places. Targeted sectors for healthcare makes all the sense in the world. We need waivers. We need all kinds of things that ultimately can be ascribed to the benefit of the economy. Infrastructure finance certainly makes all the sense in the world, although there has been a lot of cutesy stuff going on in there, this P3 and the rest of that. No disrespect, Representative Reed, but I don't think we have a project yet that has employed that methodology. And I'm just trying to figure out what will be the broad assignment, the duty responsibilities for this person.
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, I think it shifts from year to year. I mean, with the Superfund is another example where that could become a very prominent duty of this particular position. So I think it will vary from year to year exactly what those targeted sectors, and it will reflect what programs become available at the federal level, but then also what needs do we have at the state to address our delegation and others.
Who follow up?
Please.
Who does this person respond to? Who is the boss? Is this a direct report to Mr. Robbins? Is this a direct report to the governor? Where are the accountabilities? Because I think that someone 3,000 miles away may drift a little bit from the core mission and the expectations back home of deliverables. And I'm just curious who's looking at the time cards.
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, Sean might correct me on this, but I think, you know, historically this person reports to the chief of staff of the governor, and as well as the governor. I believe Business Oregon may also be required to sign off on expenses and others, but I think by and large the reporting goes into the chief of staff.
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, that is correct. We at the agency sign off on this position's time card, this position's expenses, and I believe the lease payment for the office space in Washington, D.C. That is how it has historically been structured.
Representative Woodson, you had a question?
I was wondering if you're going to open up this position to advertising for it, or if you have someone in mind.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Witsit, I am not specifically involved in the search for this particular position. It is an open position right now, and I would be happy to get back to you after talking to our chief of staff on that. It will be intended to be, though, someone that will live and work in Washington, D.C.
You can, if I may, you can get back to all of us. Sure. I'm not asking personally.
One more. I understand the federal funding piece. The foundation funding piece is a little more nebulous to me because so much of that is relationship-based. Are there going to be expectations about foundation deliverables, or do you just mention this as a possible source of funding? Because I think the model that we're shifting to more and more is this kind of collaboration between academia, private sector, government, business, philanthropy, And so is that more a term of art, or is there an expectation of some deliverable from the philanthropic sector?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, I believe that's more of a historical sense in that this position, those who've been in that, played that role, have worked with the foundations that are based in D.C. And wouldn't necessarily work with our foundations here in the state, like the Ford Family Foundation or in Community Foundation, but others like the Rockefeller Foundation and ones based in D.C. that are closely connected on the East Coast that are interested in projects and opportunities in our state.
I just want to put a follow-up. I just want to put a note of caution on the record. It has been my experience that often grant seekers tailor their mission to try to respond to the grant makers. And I have been worried for a long time, as Oregon has relied more and more on the philanthropic sector. And make no mistake, I'm very supportive. I was one of the founders of Grantmakers of Oregon and Southwest Washington. But I would hate to have policy bias begin to slip into our state ecosystem as we are in a relentless hunt for money. And when I think of some of the large foundations that clearly are associated with bias and mission, Pew immediately jumps to mind, I would be quite worried that there be some degree of accountability so that we know whose piper we're dancing to if we are accepting large blocks of philanthropic money from the mega foundations that are principally East Coast. And you don't have to respond. I'm just putting that onto the record. I think it's something we need to be vigilant about.
Chair Gomberg and Senator Johnson, appreciate the comment.
Very good.
Thank you.
This one I think is an easy one. As you know, the Oregon Arts Commission was made a part of Business Oregon years ago. And the Oregon Arts Commission is seeking two public art coordinators. Now, these are coordinators. The money already exists. There are other funds. The work is already being done within state government, but is being done by contractors and consultants. The Oregon Arts Commission is requesting the FTE limitation in order to make those individuals the same amount of money, permanent positions within the Arts Commission, to provide better service to the local communities and to the arts community to which they serve and are accountable to.
Yes, Representative Wissett.
Earlier in the session, I asked for a description for each county of your public arts coordinators, and I still haven't received that. We're told these are, at the time, all over the state in each county, and so I was wondering if you can make sure that we see what these projects are, who the people are, and just to remind you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitson, I'm sorry that you haven't received that. Brian Rogers, the Executive Director of the Arts Commission, I believe is in the back.
Okay, thank you.
We'll get it to you. Thank you, Representative Whitson. Starting to move a little more swiftly.
Chair Gomberg, can I,
yes, Representative,
can I go back to the arts thing there?
Absolutely.
So you want to add two FTEs, and right now those are, you have contractors in those positions? Then?
I believe that is correct, Representative Whitson, or Nierman.
If what's the advantage to that? So now we're going to have two state employees that we have to pay PERS to, and that kind of thing. Is it not working to have contractors, or what's wrong with that arrangement?
Chair Gomberg, if it pleases the commission, I'd actually ask Brian Rogers of the Arts Commission to be able to answer that question in a little more detail than I can.
Good afternoon, Chair Gomberg and members of the committee. Thank you for the question.
We'll just have you introduce yourself again, even though we've mentioned your name three times.
Brian Rogers, Executive Director of the Oregon Arts Commission.
Thank you.
What we have an issue with is continuity. Contractors come and go pretty frequently, and they're expensive to manage. And there's also a lot of mandate from state government about how much project management we can give to them directly. With an employee, our continuity and ability to manage projects increases pretty highly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
The POP number 13 on the list is the Natural Resource Transformative Technology Grant Program, a mouthful to be sure. Where this originally came from is a recognition on the state tour from last summer. Again, as part of our responsibility to rural communities and economies, is that when we talk about rural communities, what we really, and from an economics perspective, are talking about our natural resource economies. Really the industries of food and wood and all the variational supply chains and value-added opportunities that exist in those two sectors. So when we talk about lifting up rural economies, we're trying to be more specific around what that means. One of the interesting pieces that we heard consistently across the state was that there was just as much opportunity for innovation and entrepreneurship and new product development and technology in the natural resource industries. Witness on Mandaro vehicles as its application to precision agriculture as an example, or cross laminated timber as an example of value added wood products manufacturing within the ecosystem. The opportunities in that space are just as prevalent as any of the opportunities that have existed historically in the traditionally funded Oregon Innovation Council pathways of nanotechnology, micro devices, translational research on biology and life sciences, and building systems and energy systems. But oftentimes, those individual tracks of natural resources haven't made it to the table within the innovation discussion. So this POP number 13, I won't even say the word again because it's too much of a mouthful, this POP number 13 on transformative technology is really focused on trying to give a parallel pathway to natural resource innovation, technology development, and partnership with the university system as any of the more traditional innovation approaches that have been pursued in the past through the Oregon Innovation Council. It's a $5 million lottery fund request. It would be the first time something like this in this type of construct would be developed going forward. Part of our attempt with Tobias, Representative Reed's leadership on House Bill 2288 is taking a fundamental look at the Oregon Innovation Council Chapter 2 in the next biennium and bienniums that follow, and there may be just as easy of a pathway to incorporate elements of this into the traditional Oregon Innovation Council approach as a separate bill or track unto itself.
Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, just since I was mentioned and the bill was mentioned, just for the benefit of the senators, that bill passed the House today without opposition, so you'll see that in the Senate shortly, I suspect.
Thank you.
Please.
We're almost there. I have this unenviable task of getting you through 18 of these things. with this one, this is Vince Porter and I believe John McCardle, the Director of Development and Governor Relations for Lynn Benton Community College, are here. Vince Porter from the Governor's Office to walk you through this particular budget priority.
Thank you. I'll be very brief and just explain why we put this into the governor's recommended budget and Business Oregon. In last summer, we've continued to hear the positive news about the Lynn Benton Community College's program in the Advanced Transportation Technology Center. If you've ever gotten a chance to go out and visit and see the work that they're doing, you will meet many students who are already employed before they graduate. And so this here is a lottery bond request to expand the capacity of their program, and we've asked John McCardle from Lynn Benton Community College to give you more details on exactly the progress of the program.
Good afternoon, John McCardle. Good afternoon, Chair, committee members. John McCardle, Director of Development, Government Relations, Lynn Benton Community College. The community college is focused on workforce development, and we've had an auto and diesel program for 40 years. About 5 or 6 years ago, our national and local partners talked about the need to expand into alternative fuels, propane, natural gas, electric, biodiesel, hydrogen. They need people to do that because it saves money. Alternative fuels saves them about half their expense, lowers maintenance costs, and it makes good business sense all the way around. So this request is to expand that program. The heavy trucking industry is especially interested. We've raised for the Advanced Transportation Technology Center about $9.5 million so far. And what's really exciting is that people like Freightliner, Pape, Daimler, Northwest Natural, Co-Energy Propane, the National Propane Energy Council, and others have also invested with us in the form of cash and also in the form of in-kind contributions. Those big trucks, they ain't cheap. And so they've invested in that because they want a workforce that can help do that, and it saves money and it makes them more globally competitive. I stand ready to answer any of your questions. Yes, Senator.
Senator Johnson.
I feel like asking you questions on this is sort of like stomping bunnies. but help disabuse me of the belief that this is a capital construction project for one out of all of our community colleges.
Chair, Senator, we do... the community college does do regular everyday students just like everybody else does. But we also have incumbent worker training because that we have folks.
Mr. McCarty, you're getting way down in the weeds. Are you building a new building or not?
Yes, there is a need for facility to do that.
Okay. I guess, colleagues, my dilemma is why should one community college capital construction project get lifted out of the massive needs across the system because of the subject matter and be treated differently? Why shouldn't this compete with the other capital construction projects for the other array of community colleges that are all doing good and wonderful things?
I guess, Senator, the answer that I would offer is that this is about economic development at the request of our industry partners, because this is what they need to provide economic development and workforce training, and they just come to ask us.
I'm not trying to argue with you, but respectfully, so's the new building for nursing where the hospitals come and ask for it. So's the new building for marine science where partners come and ask for it. I'm just trying to understand why we keep in this department doing these kind of one-off asks. It seems to me that the community colleges maybe all ought to compete in the same arena and the cream comes to the surface on the priority of the projects. Match, industry excitement. I think using political will to end up in a budget versus having a more competitive environment maybe doesn't serve us by getting the really wonderful projects at all of the facilities an opportunity to compete on a level playing field. You came and visited with me about this project, and I had that question that I didn't pursue as in-depth when we were together, nor did I pursue how many of these vehicles are actually out in the marketplace being used that require technicians. I don't know if there is a fleet of compressed natural gas trucks operating right now.
To answer your question, Senator, yes, as a matter of fact, Daimler has one that they've just given us that they are now producing those kind of vehicles now, and they need people to work on it. So same thing with Freightliner. So those kind of compressed natural vehicles are now in production, and they need people to work on those kind of things. The earlier questions you have, I'm not sure if I can answer your policy question that you're asking.
Okay. Well, I just offer for the committee's consideration every one of the community colleges, and I think all of them, all of us have one or more in our districts, have pressing needs in partnership with industry for the purpose of economic development.
Additional questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Then I'll take this. Come on up.
Go ahead.
So also in our budget, members of the committee, has been put the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program, which is a $100 million general obligation bond priority item to physically rehabilitate and prepare for a seismic event schools and emergency service buildings. $70 million of the $100 million for the schools and $30 million for emergency service buildings, architecture, engineering, project management, structural improvements,
to those facilities as part of the state's overall preparation for a large seismic event at some point in the future. And the Infrastructure Finance Authority Division of Business Oregon, led by Assistant Director Lynn Schessler, would be tasked with administering this program going forward.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Whitson.
I was wondering if you are selecting the areas most likely to experience the greatest earthquake in which to seismically retrofit, and I would suggest that would be the coastal areas of Oregon. There was a picture of Roseburg something on there. I don't know. On the last, maybe it was just. So that's a question. Are you going to selectively work on areas that are most likely to experience, you know, a greater than a 7 earthquake?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, as well as Representative Whitsitt, we use a benefit cost analysis model. It's a nationally recognized tool to evaluate buildings. It includes not only their geographic location, but it's the structural nature of the building itself, the number of people that use the building, and economic value of the building, as well as its historical value. All of that's put into a, what you might call a black box model, and out comes a score. In the most recent round, we did a competition of 45 different projects, and we only had money for 15. And we used that score to announce or analyze and identify the projects that would create the greatest benefit cost for the community.
Follow up?
And where were they?
I have a full list of those if you'd like those.
Yeah, just generally, where were they?
All over the state. Some communities in eastern Oregon, some coastal communities, and up and down the Willamette Valley.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I guess one of the things, Mr. Chesler, that is continuing to elude me is that we have all of these various resiliency initiatives. We've had a group working on a resiliency plan for the state. And I'm trying to differentiate between your black box methodology of scoring and the informed study of the resiliency committee, and where do those all begin to coalesce so that there's a coherent plan and that we're actually addressing these facilities for seismic retrofit with some eye towards their vulnerability rather than just a matrix that cranks out a score, or who has the best lobbyist, or who has the most senior legislator. I think everybody can wait their turn in the barrel if they know they're going to get a turn in the barrel, but is there some coherence to how these all come together, and where do we draw all the plans into a single point of focus? Because we're not going to have enough money to fix all this stuff, whether it's a brick courthouse a long ways away from the ocean in Senator Hansel's district, or it is something right along the banks of the Columbia River in Representative Witt's district. How do we prioritize so that we're getting the most bang for the buck and addressing the greatest degree of vulnerability in the case of a, I presume we're all planning for a seismic event. I just don't know where all this planning that we're spending tons of money for comes together. Nor do I know where the scientists touch it. There are geologists, there are people, I don't know what you call them, extra special smart guys in seismology.
Seismologists.
Thank you, seismologists. where is the science that informs our prioritization?
Co-chairs. That's a really tough question to respond to from the perspective that this program addresses only one small portion of the state's resiliency plan. As you're all, I'm sure, aware, it addressed roads, you know, pipelines, all the things that would be lost in a significant event. Then you plug in, we've got schools that need repair, as well as emergency services building. Obviously, the conclusion of the report is that we need billions of dollars to address this. This is a drop in the bucket. It's the money we've been provided, and we're using the best tool we can to And it's certainly consistent with the resiliency plan. It's just it's such a small piece of the plan that I don't think there's a clear way we can identify other than it is consistent with the plan of how it all fits together.
And then one more. My other concern is we did a bill this morning on the Senate floor that commemorates the existence of a 100-year-old grade school in Senator Courtney's district. What happens if the engineers come back and say, seismically, this is a scraper? You can't fix this. It's brick or it's lath and plaster. How does all the permitting get worked through, or the conscience of the community that says you can't tear down our beloved, it's only been 7 hours and I've forgotten the name of the school. Thank you.
No.
That you can't tear down this school because it's so much a part of the core of the character of the community. Who works through all of those issues? Because I can see in some of this retrofit endless hearings. And then last but not least, where does the coordination with our land use system come from? Because I can think of the city of Seaside that's constrained by its UGB. They can't get outside the UGB to build a new school because our land use won't let them, and the school is directly in the tsunami zone. Are you guys going to, here's my question to you. Are you guys going to get stuck with all of this? Because this is going to be a breathtaking amount of regulatory, permitting, litigation, public hearings. Because you ain't asking for enough money.
Senator Johnson, you're absolutely right. There's not enough money. Fortunately for us, the bright line is pretty clear. We cannot rehab a building, a school or an emergency building, that's in the tsunami zone. It's just flat out prohibited. In terms of Senator Courtney's schoolhouse, the black box model provides us answers that clearly say this should not be rehabilitated. It's not economically feasible to rehabilitate this building. You're better served by creating a new school. Now, what happens to that school as a historic building in the community? Maybe somebody else has the money to make it the art center or the new library annex or whatever, but for us, the provisions of the program make it pretty clear that we can separate ourselves from those issues and just fund projects.
I might Please. Add, Chair Gomberg and Senator Johnson, to this conversation, a simple addendum to that, which is we are the Oregon Business Development Department. And every time we take another step towards engaging in a basket of activities that take it off our mission, it makes it increasingly more difficult to accomplish the things that you expect of us and that are part of our KPMs also. This just requires a tremendous amount of intellectual infrastructure because we happen to be good fiduciaries that take a lot of administrative effort in order for us to deploy appropriately.
You're making my point, and I'm not so sure that the legislature shouldn't rethink giving you this task. You do not have scientists. You do not have seismologists, geologists, blah, blah, blah. And I think you ended up with this program because it was not being discharged to the satisfaction of leadership at the military department. And it was, let's look around and see who we can dump it on. And you became the utility infielder once again. I am really quite concerned that you are tasked with this job of retrofitting the past when you are supposed to be building for the future. And I think that we ought to seriously give some thought to locating this responsibility within your agency. I feel a budget note sort of beginning to form.
Appreciate your comments, Senator Johnson. Moving on in the interests of time to the remaining three POPs, number 16, 17, and 18. Number 16 is the West Coast Energy Plan.
Sean, may I interrupt you for, in the interest of time, if I can give one statement to the last three slides, maybe so that you can adjourn in a timely fashion. This budget was created in the summer of 2014. I think the budget has not been, we have not changed the budget with current current administration, but I would say purposely these last three slides have been moved down to the bottom of the list. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I move to adjourn.
I love it.
Any questions? Thank you for your candor. Yeah.
And if I might offer a few closing remarks.
Please, Mr. Robinson.
To wrap up our sixth day of testimony on our budget, I want to zoom out for a quick big picture closing remark. Our agency, and this was actually a great transition, Senator Johnson, we are the Oregon Business Development Department. We are tasked with trying to increase the amount of high-quality, sustainable family wage jobs in the state. We are the state's economic development entity charged with that task, with 135 really hardworking professionals who are trying to get that job done in an increasingly complex and difficult economy. And we represent 0.76% of the overall state budget. We are a very small investment in what we all want to be probably one of the most important priorities on the list, which is job creation. And I'm hopeful that over the last 6 days, both in March and April, one of the things that we've accomplished for you is not only to demonstrate the vast diversity of the kinds of programs that we've been asked to administer and manage on behalf of the state, but also to give you a view forward and a vision forward of the type of work that's required of us into the future in order to accomplish the statutory mission that you've given us. And it's, as you can also see, it's very easy over many years to give us many tasks to do these things. And the more we do that, the harder it is, it crowds out the funding that we have to do the core business development activities of retention, expansion, startup, and recruitment. And so with that, I'm looking forward to answering any and all questions you'll have in the weeks and months ahead. And we're here for you, and we'll get you the letter on the Arts Commission as well. I know we sent one on the Cultural Trust, I was told. But as you know, there's a difference between the Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust. We'll follow up with any and all questions that you continue to have on our budget, and we're here for you. Thank you very much for the opportunity as well.
Any final questions? Mr. Robbins, thank you so much to you and your team. This committee certainly understands the role that you're playing in creating jobs and the amount of money you're getting to do it with. And there are other committees that are focusing, as you create jobs, on trying to make sure we find qualified employees for those jobs. So any final comments, colleagues? I'll go ahead and adjourn the hearing. Anything for the good of the order?
Brody, adjourn.
We are back in the normal room tomorrow, and I'll adjourn the meeting.
No, I said, hearing.